I told you when we were last together that when we came back to Exodus 22, verse 28, that I wanted to share a little something from the New Testament that is touched on by this passage. So the Exodus 22:28 passage is, "You shall not revile God," so you don't diss God, you don't talk down about God, "nor curse a ruler of your people." That is, talk badly about those in leadership. You know, I mentioned already legitimate criticization of leaders is perfectly appropriate. What we're talking about here is rudeness. And so in Acts chapter 22, we find the story of where the Apostle Paul was arrested during a riot that he didn't start, and it was assumed he was the bad guy, he was the bad player, and the tribune, that is the military leader of Jerusalem on that particular day, was going to have him roughly interrogated, which is a euphemism for get whacked, get beaten, until he told him what he wanted to know. It was a standard procedure, except it couldn't be done to Roman citizens. And so that's when Paul reveals that he was a Roman citizen, and this military tribune goes, "Oh, well, that's enough of that." And we're told in the end of chapter 22 that the next day, wanting to know the real reason why he was being accused by the Jews, he unbound him, because it was also inappropriate for him to have tied up or chained a Roman citizen, and commanded the chief priests and all the council to meet, and then he brought Paul down and set him before them. So the Roman military tribune brings his Roman citizen charge, Paul, down to the Sanhedrin chamber, which was probably on the north side of the Temple Mount. It was probably a building that had some parts of it inside the holy zone of the sanctuary building region, but other parts of it were counted as being in the court of the Gentiles. And so this allowed non-Jews, like the military tribune and the military escort that is bringing Paul here, lets them enter into the council chamber. And the goal today is to find out what it is that Paul actually did to tick off the Jewish authorities. Now, here comes the core part of the story that I want to reference. Chapter 23. Looking intently at the council, so that's the 70 members of the Sanhedrin, Paul said, "Brothers, I have lived my life before God in all good conscience up to this day." Now, that's just his introductory statement, and it is sincere. He doesn't believe that he's ever done anything out of some sort of sinful motivation. Even when he was functioning as the Sanhedrin's monkey paw, shall we say, the strong arm against the church, he was doing it in what he considered a legitimate environment for legitimate reasons. So he was living in good conscience even back then. But the moment those words come out of his mouth, verse 2 reports that the high priest Ananias, who has just recently come to this position, commanded those who stood by him to strike him on the mouth, which is not according to the rules. Paul, therefore, said to him, God's gonna strike you, you whitewashed wall. Are you sitting in judgment against me according to the law, and then contrary to the law, you order me to be struck? So we see here Paul flare up in anger that the Sanhedrin rules were violated, and he would have known because he worked with the Sanhedrin. He's been in trials with the Sanhedrin. And so he knows this was not right, and it makes him mad. And he lashes out and says, God's going to strike you, you whitewash wall. How dare you judge me according to the law and then have me stricken in direct contradiction to the rules. Now, verse 4, those who stood by said, would you revile God's high priest? So, would you diss the high priest? Would you speak so rudely to and about the high priest? And Paul said back, I did not know, brothers, that he was the high priest. So, Paul immediately responds in a repentant fashion. Remember what repentance is all about. You change your mind, which then changes your behavior. And so he realizes that he got angry and he had a knee-jerk reaction, which was inappropriate. And he even quotes for himself this passage from Exodus. I didn't know, brothers, that he was high priest, for it is written, you shall not speak evil of the ruler of your people. So Paul applies the passage against himself for allowing himself to get angry and say inappropriate things about a high priest who had done inappropriate things himself. And so I think this is a good way of reminding ourselves we Christians need to always remain in control according to God's word. We can't react in a knee-jerk fashion. We have to be the better people in any moment of disputation. We've got to take the high road always. And so that is very, very important. Now, you know the rest of the story there in Acts, I think. Paul goes a different route and says the reason he's on trial is because he believes in the resurrection from the dead, the bodily resurrection from the dead, and that causes a dispute between the Pharisees and Sadducees who debate on opposite sides of that argument. We'll leave that for the time when we finally get to the New Testament, Lord willing. Let's turn our attention back to Exodus chapter 22, verse 29. And remember, we're hitting a whole bunch of different topics here. Later on the day of that first Pentecost, God had given the Ten Commandments verbally. They were an overview of how people should behave themselves, show loving respect to God, loving respect to other people. And so now God and Moses are going over some of the more specific ways that this should be done. Verse 29, you shall not delay to offer from the fullness of your harvest, and from the outflow of your presses. And that's a reference to the tithe. Every year, once the harvests are over, the people are going to give the first tenth of all that production to God's service. And God says, you better not be trying to stiff me. It's actually stiffing of the priesthood and the Levites who are working on behalf of God. God says, don't be dragging your feet on that. Get it done. And not just that. The verse continues, the firstborn of your sons you shall give me. Remember that in the Exodus, the firstborn sons were redeemed by the Passover lamb. And God said, all of those firstborn sons belong to me now. I redeemed them. And so you have to acknowledge that. Now, he will allow them, even direct them, to pay a redemption price for those firstborn sons so that they could live for their parents, follow their parents' directives for their lives, rather than being in the priesthood. So the priests will be the substitutes for the firstborn. Verse 30, you shall do the same with your oxen and with your sheep. 7 days it shall be with its mother, and on the eighth day you shall give it to me. So all the firstborn animals also belong to God. And if there was a possibility of redeeming them with cash money, to be redeemed with a better animal if the person didn't feel that the firstborn animal was appropriate for being given to God. But even in those circumstances, both animals, the substitute and the original firstborn animal, still went into the hands of the priests and the Levites to be used in accordance with their rules and regulations. Now here we are told that just like baby boys are circumcised on the eighth day and marked as sons of the covenant, firstborn sons of the covenant, the baby animals, the firstborn baby animals, are given to God on the eighth day of their life. Now, most of them will probably just be turned into sacrifices. Others might be bottle-fed or raised in some way to adulthood to be used by the priests and Levites, but they will be in God's possession by that. Verse 31, you shall be consecrated to me. So all of you Israelis, you are supposed to be holy to me. You're supposed to be set aside for me. And therefore, you shall not eat any flesh that is torn by beasts in the field. You shall throw it to the dogs. So you don't eat animals that were not appropriately killed and butchered. If they were killed by wild animals, then you just let the wild dogs have them, because it's not appropriate food for yourself, because you are supposed to be God's people. Chapter 23. You shall not spread a false report. Now, this is another one of those passages that I think we need to harp on a bit because of the modern day context that we find ourselves in. I am very frustrated when I see my fellow Christians, let alone my fellow Americans, just passing on false information on social media or passing it on by word of mouth instead of doing a fact check on it, instead of finding out, is this true or not? Is this helpful or not? So here is God telling the Israelis, knock it off with the passing on of bad information. You need to nip it in the bud because it's detrimental to society as a whole to allow that to happen. So I'm going to encourage you, the next time you feel yourself tempted to pass on a bit of information on social media that you saw posted, take a few moments and fact check it from good, reliable sources. And if it ain't true, if it can't be vetted, don't pass it on. And I'd even go one more step. I'd say you probably need to contact the person that you know, evidently, that posted it and say, hey, this isn't true. You need to take this down. It's wrong. Because we've got to speak the truth in love and stop the lies. Stop the false information. You shall not join hands with a wicked man to be a malicious witness. Joining hands, shaking hands, making an agreement. You don't enter into an agreement with someone to pass on false information about somebody else or about a situation. Evidently, it's supposed to benefit this wicked person. So if you benefit a wicked person, you're basically becoming a participant in their wicked purposes. And we should not be, as people of light, coming into partnership with darkness. It's got to not be part of our lifestyle. Verse 2, you shall not fall in with the many, the crowd, to do evil, nor shall you bear false witness in a lawsuit siding with the many so as to pervert justice. And this goes back to the Ten Commandments again, which is the overall approach to this. You don't lie. You don't bear false witness. It doesn't matter if everybody else is on board. If that train is on the wrong track, you don't need to be on it yourself. So it doesn't matter how many passengers are on it and how excited they are to be there. You don't join them because, as it says here, they're basically trying to pervert justice. And we don't participate in that. Verse 3, nor shall you be partial to a poor man in his lawsuit. It's assumed, I think, in the context here, that in the first case, a powerful person, a rich person, is getting your assistance in perverting justice, doing something that he wants you to do, even though you've discovered that it's wrong. But it's just as wrong to lend support to a poor person if he's or she is in the wrong. We must always speak the truth. We must always be on the right, of justice. If our best friend is in the wrong, and we know it, and we're called to witness, we have to bear true testimony in that circumstance, because it's true testimony. If our worst enemy, the person that hates us and has tried to do horrible things to us, is on trial, and we have testimony that will free them, clear them of the charges, it is our moral responsibility not just simply to offer it when it's asked of us, but to offer it freely because it's the right thing to do. So we always, as believers, as the children of God, we always stand with justice. Verse 4. If you meet your enemy's ox, and when we talk about enemy here, we're not talking about somebody that's attacking you and trying to kill you. We're talking about somebody that you don't get along with, somebody that doesn't like you all that much, and you find them frustrating. We all know who those type of people are. If you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey going astray, you shall bring it back to him. Now, we don't run into too many donkeys and oxes nowadays in our societies, unless you live out in the country. So let's put it in more of our terms. If you saw your enemy neighbor's dog wandering around the street, or their cat, what are you supposed to do? Well, you're supposed to catch them and get them back to them, or at least call them up and say, hey, I just saw your dog, or I just saw your cat. I know where they're at, and I know you're missing them. That's the kind thing to do. It's the appropriate thing to do. To refrain from doing the kind thing is just as bad as doing bad things to that person. Verse 5. If you see the donkey of one who hates you lying down under its burden, you shall refrain from leaving him with it. You shall rescue it with him. Now, in their context, they're thinking about an overloaded donkey, and the donkey is just down. And you're coming by, and you see it's your bad neighbor, the person that hates you, and you just walk on the other side of the road laughing at him. That's not appropriate. Just walking on the other side of the road is not appropriate. God expects us to go and help get that donkey back up. If that means taking off some of that bundle of weight and helping them get to where they're going, that's appropriate. Put it in our modern sense. If you're driving down the street and you see that neighbor you don't get along with a flat tire, and they're clearly in distress, you stop and you help them if it's within your capability. Because that's the right thing to do. Because we belong to God. And God does the right thing for people in need. Verse number 6. You shall not pervert the justice due to the poor in his lawsuit. So you don't deprive people of their justice, regardless of their economic status. Verse 7, keep far from a false charge and do not kill the innocent and righteous, for I will not acquit the wicked. It's back to that idea of you don't bear false witness. You don't agree with people to bring people up on charges when there's no reason for it. And certainly you don't agree to help bring them to a conviction when there's not any legitimacy to the charge, because that's not right. And God is watching, and he's keeping track of it. He may not bring justice against such injustice in the here and now, but eventually he will get around to it. Verse 8, you shall take no bribe, for a bribe blinds the clear-sighted and subverts the cause of those who are in the right. So bribery is a bad thing. And there's a lot of different forms of bribery. I mean, I am frustrated by bribery that takes place in the public square, where people are promised things if they'll just throw their support behind somebody that really ought not to be supported. Because that's just a large form of bribery. If you're going to do something that is not appropriate just based on you getting something out of it, that's taking a bribe. Verse number 9, you shall not oppress a sojourner, or an immigrant is basically what's in mind here. You know the heart of a sojourner, for you were sojourners in the land of Egypt. So there is supposed to be some empathy here that all of us should engage in. And empathy can really take on a personal sense when you know what it feels like to have been in that situation. It really does get back to Jesus' golden rule. We always do to others based on what we'd like to be done to us. And so we always want people to be fair to us. We always want people to be gracious and merciful and polite to us. Well, if that's what you want, that's what you got to give. Chapter number 23, verse 10. For 6 years you shall sow your land and gather in its yield, but in the seventh year you shall let it rest and lie fallow. And this is the beginning of the sabbatical year system that we're talking about here. It will start in connection with Israel moving into the promised land and starting to work the land. And it'll work like this. They will work for 6 years in a row. It's always the same 6 years for everybody. So 6 years in a row, and then the seventh year is off of normal work. The land is still going to produce volunteer crops in the grain fields. It won't be nearly as much, but it'll be close. Of course, all the fruit trees and the vineyards and things, they're going to produce on their own, whether people are working with those plants or not. And so those plants that produce in the seventh year, they can be harvested on an as-needed basis by the people who own the properties. So if you're needing to make some bread, you can go out in the field and cut enough wheat stalks that you can take that grain and turn it into the bread for the day. Same thing with, you want to make an apple pie. You can go out and take enough apples off that tree to make an apple pie. But you don't go out and harvest it like you normally do. However, the poor can go out and harvest as much as they want in the seventh year from all of those fields. It says that the poor of your people may eat, and that they leave the beasts of the fields, and what they leave, the beasts of the fields may eat, and you shall do likewise with your vineyard and with your olive orchard. So the harvests in the seventh year were actually intended for the poor people to gather in and to use as they saw fit. It was a form of social assistance. And the edges of the fields will actually be done that way every work year as well. And we'll talk about that. So it's always, you're looking out for the other people. The crops honestly belong to God. And therefore, God says, make sure you share them. And then we have the mention of the Sabbath again, verse 12, 6 days you shall do your work, but on the seventh day you shall rest, that your ox and your donkey may have rest, that your son of your servant woman and the alien may be refreshed. So they have been working without a break for generations. Now God says there's going to be a public day of rest for the entire community. Everybody has to obey it for the sake of the people around them.